Okay, good evening. Tonight's work is really an amazing work. This is the actual English translation, Eim Habanim Semecha. The reason why this is an amazing work is really on two levels. Number one, this is amongst the many, many books that exist in the world on the Holocaust, and the many, many books which exist on the land of Israel. This work was, I can't say it's completely unique, but it's in a small handful of books that was written during the Holocaust. Not by a survivor who wrote afterwards, as most have been done, but literally during the Holocaust years, a personal witness to many of the atrocities was written literally during the Holocaust. And that gives it a unique perspective. Second reason why this is a unique and fascinating work is because the author, who is a saintly Chassidish Rebbe, big Talmud Chacham, as we'll speak about in a moment, literally does, through this work, a 180-degree turn on his entire worldview on Zionism. As we'll discuss, he was raised from a certain perspective, and he changes it completely. And so that gives us, the readers of this work, these two unique perspectives on what it is that we will be able to see as we read his words through the era of the Holocaust, first-hand account, and this perspective on a theological approach to understanding the Holocaust, which is always, those of us afterwards can never dare to suggest a reason why something would happen. We can't. But he does. From the furnace, he makes his suggestions as to why this is, and gives us a whole new perspective on the land of Eretz Yisrael. It's fascinating. So there are a couple of different ways to study a book like this, a work like this. Good evening. Here, there's some sheets over here. One way is, as one of my colleagues has done, you can look it up on YU Torah, he has 30, 35 classes. He literally goes through the entire work and breaks it down, goes in order, and you can, if you want to learn it in depth, you can have an approach. 35 classes you can go through. It's an amazing, amazing work, and it's worth it. The other approach is a one-hour lecture on the work, as many times you do, and you give a little summary. So I've decided to try to find the right balance for us, what I hope will work, which is a three-part series, which will not go all 30, which whatever numbers are here now, I think would be significantly less by the time we got to number 30, and one won't do it justice. But hopefully a three-part series will be able to get a real feel for it, a flavor of what it's about, and hopefully will inspire you to want to be able to learn and understand even more. Let's start in your notes. Let's jump right in with a little bit of a historical background. So this is a theological work. The author's name is Rav Shlomo, Yisachar Shlomo Teichtel. And the Holocaust, even though he's writing a theological work, it's beyond our explanation, it's beyond comprehension. Even after the 70 years of hindsight that we have, we can't, as I mentioned before, you can't really dare begin to explain, express. It's beyond all of us. But he's writing in the furnace. He's writing during the destruction. He begins writing it in 1942 in hiding. He publishes it in Budapest in 1943. Remember, of course, Hungary was taken very late in the war, so he still had a little freedom of movement, even though most of the time he is hiding during the time that he is writing this particular work. And he is going to attempt to explain some of the whys. Why is this taking place? And more than attempting to explain some of the whys, he's going to attempt to explain how to end. Again, he's writing in the midst of it, how to end the oppression and the horrors of what we were witnessing, what we were experiencing with restoration and redemption. Okay, his name again, Rabbi Yisachar Shlomo Teichtel. He was born in 1885 in Hungary to an illustrious Hasidish family. He had saintly and scholarly teachers. He was what we would call an Eloi. He was a genius. He learned the list of the great Gedolei Yisrael, who he lists as his Rebbes, as his mentors, is long. By the time he is 20, he is already receiving questions that he's answering and writing responses. He prints his first sefer at the age of 24 of all of the questions that he's already received and answered. He receives smicha from three different rabbanim in Europe, and he eventually settles in a town in Czechoslovakia known as Pishtian. I'm sure I'm pronouncing it incorrectly, which till this day is a well-known town because it's a big spa. They have a lot of mineral baths, and people would go there to recuperate. And he would come into contact with many of the leaders of the Jewish world who would come there during various times. And he published numerous works. He had a yeshiva, and he had personal connections with rebbes from Belz, Sanz, Munkach. He was a big Talmud Chacham. He was a well-known player. Now, some of you might recognize some of these Hasidic groups, Munkach particularly, as being very well known as being anti-Zionist, to say the least. And he himself was raised with that perspective. And that was the overwhelming response, not just of Munkach and Satmar Hasidim. That was the general Orthodox approach. And we'll hopefully have opportunity to speak a lot more about this in over years and months and months and years of Jewish history discussing different things. But in the early years, in the 30s and the 40s, the Zionist movement was overwhelmingly anti-religious, anti-Torah, secular, socialist. It really was not a movement that the religious world jumped in on. That happens much later. And he was of that approach, which most of the Jewish world was, the religious Jewish world was at the time, which was a born out of a false messiah. There in the 1700s, Shabtai, 1600 was Shabtai Tzvi, and then Yaakov Frank in the 1700s. These false messiahs had a massive impact on the Jewish world, and the idea of anything messianic, of returning to the land of Israel, and messiahs and Mashiach's coming was overall just a disaster for the Jewish people. And so there was a tremendous, you said Messiah, and everyone was like, I don't want anything to do with that. That's just the way that it was for literally at this point in time, almost 200 years of really wanting nothing to do with that. The Enlightenment movement had taken hold, which was a very secular movement, which many Jews had become big time parts of, and that all of those things did not help the religious world. So the religious world was very opposed to it. Certainly the Hasidic world, very much. It was a dangerous movement. The Zionist movement was a dangerous movement for the religious Jews, and so they wanted to be very distant from it. We could talk more about that, but I want to get into the work. But that was the worldview that he had and that he espoused to, as many did. However, in 1942, deportations begin in his city. And as that happens, he and 10 other families hide in the attic of the local Beis Medrash. So he had a yeshiva, there was a shul, and in the attic, he and 10 families are hiding in the attic as the deportations are beginning in his town. And from the cracks of the walls of his hiding spot, he literally looks out and sees and hears his townspeople being rounded up. The screams, the cries, the beatings, and he's literally watching it from his place in hiding. Now, we know in hindsight how things were playing themselves out and what happened, but this is, they didn't have, Instagram in those days. It wasn't like, oh, I knew exactly what was happening out throughout the rest of it. He's like watching this unfold. They heard rumors of terror and rumors of what was going on, and now he's watching it and he's seeing it. And he does really an amazing thing because, as you can imagine, if you could take any example in which you held a worldview for a significant portion of your life, and it's a worldview that you held strongly, and you spoke about and taught about. We have letters that he wrote, strong anti-Zionist letters, saying how it's a horrible thing, it's ruining the land. We know what he held. And then to go through a life experience and be willing and able to say, I made a mistake, I think it's wrong, and come up with a whole new worldview, and very publicly do so, is not a simple thing. And he does that. And what he does, as he's watching this from his hiding spot, is he takes a neder, takes a vow. And the vow that he takes is that if he survives this horror, he's going to write a book about the land of Israel, and he's going to spend the rest of his days encouraging the Jews to leave the exile that they're in, and to return to the land of Israel. He describes a little bit about that process, and I just want to share from his words a little bit of how he did this, to re-examine the history of our people. So he writes in his introduction, as you see in the notes here, this is just a brief intro, and then I want to actually just read his words. We'll do for the rest of the evening. The first box on page one is a letter that he came across from the Baal HaTanya. The Baal HaTanya was the famous founder of Chabad Hasidus, Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi. And the Baal HaTanya wrote a letter in 1799 to the Berditcheva Rebbe, in which the Baal HaTanya, Rav Shneur Zalman, informs the Berditcheva Rebbe that he was released from prison in Petersburg. And the letter that he wrote is in the first box, translated as follows. This is a brief excerpt. I shall recount and declare that which is too great to tell. he says, of my freedom. By the way, the Chabad Hasidim still to this day, they celebrate the 19th of Kislev as the day that the Rebbe was freed from prison. So in his letter, he says, let me tell you about it. Hashem has done wondrously in the land that this is all Hashem's doing. He has arranged this by virtue of the merit of the Holy Land and its inhabitants. This is what has stood by our side and will always assist in relieving us from the oppressor and delivering us from distress. And what should strike you? Now again, you know what the topic of our talk tonight is. But what's odd about the Rebbe's letter in 1799 as he's freed from Petersburg, and he says, you know why this happened?
God.
What does he put the merit on? The merit of the land of Israel and those living in the land of Israel, right? Hashem has done wondrously, and in what merit did Hashem do wondrously? Merit of Eretz Yisrael. 1799 in Petersburg, and you're saying you were freed because of the merit of Eretz Yisrael? So, Rav Teichtara, I don't know what he was talking about. Where is he coming up with this idea that it's the merit of the land of Israel that is freeing him? That's somehow, where is that? He says, and then I found it. Now, as he's writing, you have to remember he's writing in 1942, and the town in which he started in Czechoslovakia was overrun by the Nazis. He eventually, in his full biography, which is written up in the beginning of the book, Shul has a number of these copies, it's a wonderful book. The English translation traces the various places that he was on the run. In almost all the places that he went to, he didn't have a library, he didn't have peace of mind. He's writing almost everything from what he remembered, by heart, as he recalled sources. Which makes it even more amazing. It's one thing if a person had a life's work and they were about to write it up, and then they were sent to some tumultuous situation and they had to write it out by heart. But it was their life's work. So they knew all their sources, they were preparing to write it. But can you imagine if you changed your entire worldview and then from memory were able to pull out all the sources that you need for your new worldview, not because you were preparing to write that book, because I've re-examined life, and now I have all these sources that I'm going to think about in a new way. So he says, I found the source for the Rebbe's letter. And the source is on the bottom box, on page one, a pasuk at the end of Bechukosai. Now you might recall, the end of Bechukosai is what's known as the Tochacha, the terrible calamities, the curses the Torah describes of what will happen if we don't follow in the ways of the Torah. At the end of all of those horrible descriptions, the Torah describes, I will remember, v'zacharti es brisi Yaakov, I'll remember my covenant with Yaakov, es brisi Yitzchak, and my covenant with Yitzchak, v'gam es brisi Avram ani eskor, I'll also remember my covenant with Avram, v'gam es ha'oretz ani eskor, and also the land. Now, there's something strange about the order of the Avos, which is, of course, it's backwards. We started, Hashem says, I'll remember Yaakov, I'll remember Yitzchak, I'll remember Avram. So Rashi right away notes, why are the Avos listed in reverse order, Rashi says? L'hagilucha, Rashi says, to tell us that Yaakov, who is the Katan, the youngest of them, is Kedai. The redemption that Hashem is describing in this pasuk. Remember, this is a pasuk describing a Holocaust. The Tochacha, the admonition of Sefer Parashat Bechukosai, is a Holocaust. And it's going to end in the merit. It's Kedai, Yaakov's merit alone is Kedai, it's worthy. And if it's not sufficiently worthy, then Yitzchak is going to be with him. And if he and Yaakov together are not sufficiently worthy, then I still have Avram. That's what Rashi says. So it's going, Yaakov should be enough. And if he's not, I have Yitzchak, and if not, I have Avram.
Well, why does he stop there?
That's all Rashi, well, that's, what do you mean, why does who stop there?
Why does Rashi stop there?
That's Rashi, because he asks on the Avos.
Okay.
So the Rebbe asks, I know, that's where we're going. So the Rebbe of Teichtel, the author of this work, says, but wait a minute, there's a fourth element in the pasuk. The pasuk says, I'm going to remember Yaakov, Yitzchak, Abraham, and the land. So the Rebbe Rav Tachtel says, oh, you see clearly the way the Rashi is saying it. And even if Avram is not Kedai, which Chazal say, there will be a time which we're in right now, Tamu Zuchus Avos, the merit of our fathers, we can't rely on their merit anymore. We rely on them to have the audacity to stand before Hashem, and we say, Elokei Avram, Elokei, I can only stand before you as an Einikol, but the Zuchus Avos, the Gemara says, it's been a long exile, we ran out of that. But what comes after the three Zuchus Avos? I'll still remember the lands. So Rav Techtel says, I see, you have a proof from here, that indeed the land has a schus. There's a certain merit of the land of Eretz Yisrael. That's the last thing. That will always, always be on our side. Just the merit of the land. He quotes another. Again, when Moshe is standing, when Klal Yisrael is standing at the Yam Suf, coming out of Mitzrayim, and so they look at one side, the Egyptians are coming to pursue them, and they look at the other side of the sea, and they're stuck. There's nowhere for them to go. This is one of the first times as a nation, we're hopeless. We're going to be destroyed. So Moshe starts davening, and Hashem says, Matitzak Eli, why are you calling out? Dabro b'nei viso, tell the Jewish people to go. So the Medrash says on that pasuk, what do you mean? How could they go? There's nowhere for them to go. The Medrash says, Rabbi Shmuel, the bottom line, through the merit of Yerushalayim, I'll split the sea. What do you mean the merit of Yerushalayim? Yerushalayim doesn't even exist yet. There's a merit of Yerushalayim. When a Jew is in Bein HaMitzarim, when a Jew is between the narrow straits, and there's nowhere for him to turn, he's got the Egyptians on one side and the sea on the other, and you tell him, you're going to be saved. How am I going to be saved? Schus of Yerushalayim, as the Rebbe writes, Yerushalayim represents the entirety of Eretz Israel. So the Rebbe says, I see from here that we're in this Holocaust that we're in right now. It's 1942, 1943 that he's writing in. With what are we going to be spared? How are we going to get out of this? It's only going to be in the schus of the land. So he took a neder, like Yaakov Avinu. Yaakov, as we're going to read in the parsha or two, as he leaves Eretz Yisrael, what does he say? If Hashem, if you'll be with me, Ushmarani b'derech asher elech, if you'll guard me on the way that I'm going to go, and you give me bread to eat and clothing to wear, and you return me safely, so then aser tase, I'll give you a tenth of everything that I have. So the Rebbe took a neder and said, if you'll be with me, and you'll get me through this war, and you'll give me bread to eat and clothing to wear, I will dedicate my life to writing about Eretz Yisrael and spreading the word that this is really what the Jews need. This is what's going to get us out of our problems. His family was captured in late 1944 from all the places in which they were on the run. They were sent to Auschwitz. And he tragically died on a train. His son, who survived, there are many descendants of Rav Teichtel in Eretz Yisrael today. His son, who survived, writes that he died on the train when they were being transported and transferred from Auschwitz to Mauthausen. And one of the train stops, the guards threw a few crusts of bread into the train. And a Jew ended up with a small crust, and one of the Ukrainian prisoners grabbed it from him. And the Jew who had it grabbed from him was pleading, I'm going to die. That's all I have. And Rav Teichtel stepped in to try to get the bread back from the Ukrainian. And his son writes, very poignantly, we begged him, Abba, you know, they probably called him Tati, like, leave it alone. You can't. And the Rebbe said, but this Jew is going to die. This is Pikuach Nefesh. And he intervened, and the Ukrainian beat him to death there on the train in between as he was being transferred. And so that's the martyr's death that he perished with, but we have his works, we have his writings, which survived. Okay, so what I'd like to do with a little bit of time that we have is the introduction. He wrote actually two or three different introductions before he actually gets into his main work. And so I want to read it because his words speak for themselves. They're beautiful. This was translated in Israel by Rav Moshe Lichtman. And these are his words. During the Passover, he starts with, in his introduction, the chasm between the irreligious and the religious communities. The secular community at the time was mostly behind Zionism, and the religious community, as I mentioned, to a great degree, was very, very opposed. And for good reasons. For good reasons. It was a secular movement. If you lived in the 1930s in Europe, and your child was a Zionist, that almost, by definition, meant that he wasn't going to be religious. So if you came from a religious home, again, this is so not our world today. It's hard to go back in time, but it's important to understand. That's the truth. It wasn't like B'nai Akiva movements. That wasn't the way that it was. If you had, you know, every generation has its youth, and the youth want whatever they want, and the parents are always afraid of, you know, what's coming. How do we protect our youth from whatever the movement is? So in much of Europe, that Zionism was a secular, anti-religious, anti-Torah. And so if your kid came home with Zionist ideas, so you were afraid, that means he's probably not going to be religious. That's where things were going. So for good reason, the religious didn't jump on the boat right away. But he's going to take them to task. And it's an amazing thing to read this paragraph. So he says, during the past few decades, during the past few decades. Again, he's writing in the 1940s. The Zionist movement, as we know, began in the 1880s already, the first wave of Aliyah. So sort of the Zionist movement has been around for 50 years, 60 years, really, at this point. First Zionist Congress was in the early 1903, 1904, 1897 was the first one, so it's been around. During the past few decades, the irreligious have opened their eyes and recognized their mistake in thinking that they will find their heart's desire here in exile. They realize that, he says. They understand you're never going to be happy, you're never going to be accepted. Exile is not a place for a Jew. They have seen the hostility surrounds them from all sides, and in response to their love of the non-Jews, the Gentiles hate them and persecute them without reason. So they open their eyes and recognize that their hopes of finding peace and quiet here in exile are futile. The desire to return to the land of our forefathers awoke within them, and they began working towards this goal. There, and this is literally what Herzl said, like, we're never going to be accepted here, we need our own place. So he said, the irreligious figured this out, he writes. The secular Jews figured out that this is not our home. Those who tremble at the word of Hashem, of course, which is the translation of a Haredi, right? But the Haredi community, as we know, it wasn't in that, they didn't refer to the religious community, however, stood on the side and refrained from sharing in the work. They didn't join in what was going on. They stood by their age-old claim of, it is preferable to sit and do nothing. Anyone familiar with that phrase from the Gemara? Shev va'altase. If you're not really sure what to do, so the Gemara says, so if you don't know, sitting and doing nothing is always better than doing something that might be harmful. So do nothing. So he says, meanwhile, the land is being built, the secular Jews are coming home, and what are the religious doing? Shev va'altase, don't do anything. So we sat on the sidelines. They let our sacred mother, meaning Eretz Yisrael, wallow in the dirt and remain in ruins. They let her eyes become a fountain of tears to cry and lament over us because we remain in exile and we do not contemplate longing to return to her bosom and to reestablish her home. In the meantime, while the religious community is sitting and doing nothing, these initiators, who's referring to, of course, the early pioneers, they began rebuilding our holy land. So may it continue and prosper. You love how he throws in the little bracha, right? They should be successful. While the Orthodox Jews and the Tzaddikim stood aloof. And it is clear that he who prepares prior to the Shabbos will eat on Shabbos. The Gemara says in the classic way, you know, Shabbos, if you don't prepare, what are you going to eat? So who's preparing the land? Since the Orthodox, listen to this line, since the Orthodox did not toil, they have absolutely no influence in the land. Those who toil and build have the influence, and they are the masters of the lands. It is therefore no wonder that they are in control, for he who guards the fig tree will eat of its fruit. So he says, you're complaining that the land of Israel is secular, you're complaining that it's not Shomer Shabbos, you're complaining that it's not being done al pi halacha. Well, guess what, he says. Who went and drained the swamps? Who went and risked their lives? Who went and built? Who planted? You're sitting in Eastern Europe in your yeshivas, which is very nice, we'll get back to it in the end. But who's doing all the work? Those who do the work are in control. They're the masters of the land. They're the ones who are going to dictate how things are going to go. And our secular brethren, they came. They came. Now he then says, and he moans, had it been that it had become that the Jews, the religious Jews had gone and joined in, how many more Jews would be alive today if there had been a place that they had all had a place to go? But nobody wanted to go to Palestine. That wasn't a place that was an option for the religious world. And so instead, we're being slaughtered in Eastern Europe because it wasn't a place. And then he says, well, I'd like to at least try to judge them favorably. Let's try to be melamed tzchus on the religious community that didn't go. See, he says they were cautious. Again, as I mentioned, at the end of the day, it wasn't a religious place. So they were cautious. But he says, the Chovos Halvavos, a wonderful work, writes, one of the components of caution is not to be overly cautious. If you're overly cautious, you'll end up doing nothing in life. He writes, if one waits for all the positive attributes to be fulfilled, no one would accomplish anything. The paths of goodness would be desolate, and the habits of kindness would be abandoned if everything had to line up. If a person waited just everything is right, then I'll do it. Yeah, I'll start this good project when you'll wait forever. It's never the perfect time. Okay, so it wasn't perfect. But no, how cautious can you be? And then he complains, and worse than the religious community not jumping in, worse than them waiting until it was the perfect circumstances, instead of rebuilding the land, they made the idea abominable and abhorrent. If you go back again to the historical debates of the 20s, the 30s, and went into all the way into the 40s between the religious community and the secular community about Zionism, the religious community, to protect themselves and their children, made it an abhorrent thing. Zionism was a nasty word. That was a terrible insult to call somebody a Zionist, because it meant they weren't a Torah Jew, they weren't religious, they didn't believe, they were not godly, all those things. So he said, well, guess what you did by doing that? He chastises the religious community. You made the land of Israel abhorrent and abominable, to be despised and detested. You became a modern day Meraglim. Meraglim came back and said, it's an Eretz Ochelas es Yoshva, it's a land that eats its inhabitants, this place is terrible. It's the same thing that's going on today. Again, we're 70, 80 years later, so it's so different today. But this is what was going on in the time. And then he goes on to bottom of page 2. The idea, the concept of the desire to be in the land. So now he's writing in Budapest. So he quotes a pasuk from Yirmiyahu. I will truly implant them in this land with all my heart and with all my soul. Hashem says that he's going to plant us, the Jewish people, in the land with all of his heart, capital H, and all of his soul. So the Gemara picks up on this idea that Hashem will truly implant us with all his heart and all his soul, but only if we're in the land. So the Gemara says, if they are not upon this land, then they are not truly implanted before me, neither with my heart nor with all my soul. A Jew in the land is connected with Hashem in a way that a Jew outside of the land, it's not with all my heart. But again, Hashem doesn't have a heart and a soul, but it's not with it. It's, you're in the land, yes. Outside of the land, it's not the same. Then he writes, Chazal maintained that those who die outside the land will be resurrected only after the suffering, the pain of rolling through underground tunnels. This is a reference to Gemara. It's oft quoted. Exactly what it means, I can't say, but I'll just take it at face value for now. That when Tchiyas HaNesim happens, when those who have passed on are brought back to life, so we're all going to gather in the land of Israel. But those who are buried in Israel will be there. Those who are buried outside the land of Israel, the Gemara describes part of a Yisurin, a painful experience of, so to speak, rolling through the ground to get there before they could be resurrected. As if Tchias HaMesim can only happen in Israel. You got to get there. So there's going to be a process of rolling through. It's a difficult process, so to speak. That's what the Gemara says. This is why it's always been from the time from Avram already, as we're Belech Lecha, we're going to talk about next week's parashah, buying a burial plot for Sarah. A Jew being buried in the land of Israel has always been a tremendous mile, a tremendous value. Rabbi Beryl Wein talks about, historically speaking, again, we live in a different era, but for almost all of our exile period of history, you know, from the Middle Ages all the way until the late 1800s, the land of Israel was a place that Jews went to die. Those who wanted to be buried, there was no economy, there was no community, it was tiny. The Jews were in exile. But if you wanted to be buried in Israel, so it wasn't like now, you get yourself on a plane and fly over there. If you died outside the land of Israel, you were going to be buried outside the land of Israel. But those Jews who wanted to be buried in Israel, so you had to get there before you died. So it was a retirement community. People would go there. You know, there was no economy, there were no schools, it didn't have what you needed to, right? But the elderly community, people wanted to die, be buried in Israel, would go there to die. That's where Beryl Wein used to always would point that out. So, back to Rav Teichtel's writing. This is Rav Chaim, the brother of the Maharal, writes that a person who strives to move to Eretz Yisrael, but dies outside the land, somebody who really wanted it, They tried, they yearned, they made it, they couldn't get there for whatever reason, it wasn't the right time, but they wanted it. Deep in their hearts, they wanted it. So the Maral's brother, Reb Chaim, writes, he will be spared this pain and is considered as one who resided in Eretz Yisrael and will be resurrected in an upright position without this pain. So even if Nebuch was buried outside of the land, But if he was a Jew who lived with his heart in the land, then he's considered as if he died in the land. That's what the Maharal's brother writes. By the way, I forgot to give you a warning. Reading the Sefer, you're going to like be on the next flight out of here. It's just the way that it is. It's, I told my wife, she said, oh, you're going to get the class? Or in the morning. I said, I'm not coming home tonight. I'm on the next flight. Like when you talk, like you just, it's hard. It's hard to be here and learn a work like this. But that's just my disclaimer. I'm still here also, but it's hard. Anyway, so he writes thus, this is very important for all of us living here. He who sets his eyes and heart upon moving to Israel is considered as if he's already there. It follows then, if that's where a Jew's heart is, my heart is libi b'mayram. My heart, v'mizrach. My heart is there. I'm there. Okay, I live here. But I'm not here. I'm there. So then, if we dedicate our thoughts to returning to our holy land, we will immediately cling to God's entire heart and soul. Since the original pasuk we started with says, Hashem is connected to the Jews in Israel, but I'm there. Nebuch, I'm stuck. I'm not in the land. But I'm there, really. His divine presence will keep a watchful eye over us to rescue us from our enemies and bring success to our endeavors. We will ascend to Zion joyously, and the children of Israel will go forth with a high hand from both physical and spiritual exile. He will renew our spirits as we yearn to serve Him. In other words, what's the way out of the Holocaust? The way is to connect to Eretz Yisrael. This is radical. This is radical in 1943. But the way out, at this point, if there were those saying a reason for why European Jewry was going through the Holocaust it was going through, if there were voices saying a reason, the reason would be because of Zionism. A number of other things people came up with, but Zionism was a big one. And here's a radical voice from a Hasidish Hungarian Rebbe saying, no, the solution to the Holocaust is in our hearts we're there. If in our hearts we'll be there, we'll be with Hashem's heart and soul, so to speak, and that will be the end of our terrible suffering. Let's continue. Top of page 3. One more last important paragraph. The essential point. This is amazing. This is a very important point. The essential point is that Hashem is waiting for us to take the initiative, to desire and long for the return to Israel. He does not want us to wait for Him to bring us there. I remember my going through elementary school, there's this idea of waiting for Mashiach. Waiting. This was the primary thought process of most of European Jewry. Our job is to wait. Our job is to wait for the sound of the shofar. Mashiach is here. I have a suitcase packed. I'm ready. They say, no. Your job is not to wait. Your job is to go. And when you go, Mashiach will come. Mashiach's waiting for us, not us waiting for Mashiach. This is a topic unto itself. There are lots of sources going both ways, but he's writing very strongly. It's not about waiting with your suitcase. It's about packing your suitcase and going. And when you go, Mashiach is going to come because we'll be there. But it's the wrong approach to wait for Him to take us there. We're watching this happen now, by the way, if you didn't notice. We're literally watching it happen. For 2,000 years of our exile, we're waiting for Mashiach, right? Waiting for Mashiach. Meanwhile, since the 1880s, we now have half of the world Jewish population already there. And we all know the numbers, the way things are going. That number is only getting more. 20 years from now, it'll be 60%, assuming no, just if life just continues the way on the path we're on right now. 50 years from now, we're talking 7 or 8 years. What will happen in the end? Will it be that Mashiach will come and bring us, or will we all have gotten there? Mashiach is going to say, oh, great, they're home. It's time to come. That's what's happening in front of us. It's literally playing itself out over the last 80 years in front of our very eyes. The last couple lines in that first paragraph on top of page 3, he therefore told us, and I will truly implant them in this land with all my heart and all my soul. That is to say, when we, of our own volition, truly with all our strength, desire, and strive to return to the land, then Hashem will bring our work to a successful end. I remind you, he's writing 5 years before the founding of the state of Israel. There is no state when he's writing this. It doesn't exist. There's no El Al. There's no IDF. None of that exists. He's saying, get on your horse and wagon and get yourself over there. So Nu, he asks, why haven't we gone already? So he says, Rashi in Kedushin states, second box on page 3, that the Jews who dwelled comfortably in exile did not go up with Ezra to Israel. This is in the time of the second Beis HaMikdash, after the Purim story. Ezra and Nechemiah lead the Jews back. But the Navi says the Jews didn't want to go with him. They'd been already 70 years in Persia. And you know something? Things were nice. Things were good. They became important people. They became wealthy people. They built beautiful homes. They didn't want to go. Only the poor and the dejected souls came. The Navi says this. 44,000 Jews, only 44,000 came with Ezra to rebuild the second Beis HaMikdash. Everybody else said, it's better here in exile. I don't want to go back. Furthermore, he writes, Sefer Doros Kweitz Rabbi Eliezer of Worms, one of the most horrific things to read, that Ezra sent letters to all the diaspora communities urging them, come back home. One such letter arrived in the city of Worms in Germany. The Jews residing there answered allegedly, listen Ezra, you may dwell in the great Jerusalem, but we'll dwell here in the small Jerusalem. And they said this because they were very important in the eyes of the ministers and of the Gentiles, and they were extremely wealthy, they lived peacefully. We don't want to go back to the land of it. It's dangerous, it's poor, it's backwards, we're not interested. And therefore the Sefer Doros writes, that this is why the terrible decrees that have befallen the Jews of Germany, Worms in particular, more than any other community. They settled there at the time of the destruction of the first temple, and 70 years later, when Ezra said, come home, they refused. And indeed, we see from the history of our people that all of the troubles and the evil decrees have emanated from Germany, just like today. It all stems from the sin of refusing to ascend with Ezra, which happened because they lived peacefully in exile. This has always been the case. When Jews live comfortably in exile, they do not want to hear about Aliyah to Eretz Yisrael. Always. You think about what's gone on in Eretz Yisrael the last 70 years. Which communities flock to the land of Israel? All the communities that are having major tzaras. Come from Iran, come from Iraq, they come from France now. Russia, where there's problems, the Jews run. Where things are good, the United States is one of the smallest percentages of per capita of Jews making Aliyah because, I don't need to tell you, you got what you had in the five towns. You're like, this is amazing. So it's hard to leave. And Israel's catching up. It's like harder to make that. It's like we're getting there. But this has always been our problem. It's almost as if the choice has always been, the choice is, you want to wait for it to get really bad and then go? Or would you like to go when it's nice and you can sell your house for a nice profit and go in on your own terms? But one way or another, we're ending up there. We're either running for our lives or we're doing it on our terms. But we're not here. This is not our home. And it's not going to last forever. Our great-grandchildren, God willing, will not be here. It's like we're at the end of the line already. So which way do you want? Jewish history has said, we go with trouble. That's what gets us home. So we wait for trouble or we go on our own. But that's just that's the way that it's been. And he writes this already, and he's writing in the middle of the Holocaust. So he could say it. I'm just repeating his words. Nu, how much longer? Section E, how much longer? One more paragraph. What was that? This is a kol dodi dofek. My beloved is knocking, begging me to come home. That we have that same call. Ezra wrote letters. We hear the knock. Nu, come home. I gave you your land back. I gave you everything that you need. Come home. Come home to me. Okay, section E. How much longer? Quote from the Kabbalist in the Mishnah Chasidim. All your cities will be a ruin. The Pasuk in Vayikra again, describing the terrible calamities of the Teufelka. All your cities will be a ruin. In the year 1718, Hashem granted me the privilege to ascend to Israel, to Tzfat. Says the Kabbalist, the Mishnah Chasidim. I saw with my own eyes how this curse has come true, that the cities are just in ruin. There was nothing there in the 1700s. Due to our many sins, even Mark Twain in the late 1800s writes, why is everybody talking about this land? It's desolate. There's nothing here. It's completely filled, destroyed houses. There's nothing there. However, he writes, in the 2 years that I was there, I was happy to see day by day it was being rebuilt. I claim that this is a sign of the imminent arrival of the Redeemer. For if he were to come when Israel's in a state of ruin, there'd be no place for the ingathered exiles to dwell. You have to build up the land. You have to have a place for the people to come. If all the Jews would move from the five towns now, where are they going? So first we need to build, and then everybody will come and they'll have a place to live. And he says, indeed, this is the pattern. This is the first time we entered the land. After 40 years in the desert, the rabbi said, Chazal said that Hashem detained the people of Israel in the desert for 40 years so that the land could regain its original strength. Listen to this. I'm not familiar with this imagery, but this is what he quotes from the Zohar. That when the Jews left Egypt, the Amoraim destroyed and uprooted the trees and the buildings, thinking that the Jews were coming right away, which was the original plan. So they destroyed everything. And so then God only brought them in after in a time to be rebuilt and rejuvenated. And this is what's going to happen when Mashiach arrives. May he come speedily in our days. For he will reveal himself first in this land, as the Zohar states. And now the author of Techtel writes, I was awestruck by this discovery, for I saw it in a heavenly response to the question, how much longer until Israel is rebuilt? He can't bring 7 million Jews to an empty land. So we're watching this process as he's describing it unfold. It's being rebuilt, and as it's being rebuilt, the Jews are coming. And as we rebuilt, every apartment building that's put up, it's bought up. We just need homes, and everybody slowly but surely. Just amazing to read about this written in the 1940s. Okay, why this title? Last couple points. Why did he call Ema Banim Samecha, which means a joyous mother of children? So he says, I wrote this work and entitled it Ema Banim Samecha, based on a Yerushalmi. There's Yerushalmi, which refers to Eretz Yisrael as the mother of Israel, and the lands of our exile as the stepmother. The Gemara Yerushalmi, Maseches Brachos calls it. And everybody knows, a mother's love of a child is, of course, fundamentally different than a stepmother's love. A stepmother, hopefully, also loves the child, but not like the mother. And very often, a stepmother doesn't love the child at all. So the nations which host us, they're like a stepmother. Sometimes we get good stepmothers, sometimes we get not such good, sometimes on the outside they're good, but really on the inside they're not. But that's the dynamic. Eretz Yisrael loves us unconditionally. Eretz Yisrael is that's the mama, that's our mother. And therefore she cries and laments over us when we are in exile. This is the theme we talk about Tisha B'Av all the time. Like the land of Israel, the Shekhinah, Hashem himself, they're mourning, they're crying over us, waiting for us to return home. So he describes an incident. So I want to read part of it. I didn't put it all here. 1942, again, the girls, the Jewish girls of Slovakia were beginning to be rounded up. And he describes that as the announcements were going out, there was a father who endeavored to sneak his two daughters out into, they were going to cross into Hungary. So to cross the border. So it was Chol HaMoed Pesach, and the man took his two children and promised his wife that he would send a telegraph as soon as he crosses the border, informing her that he and the two girls are safe. It's, again, in hindsight, like, they're worried about the girls. At that stage, they were just rounding up the teenage girls and taking them away. So the mother sits at home by herself, alone, without her husband, without her two girls, waiting and anticipating, longing for the moment that she would receive the news that they made it safely across the border. However, he writes, it happens that right before they crossed the border, the father and the daughters were actually seized and transported to a nearby village where they were placed in a prison, and there they remained for all of Pesach and in grave danger any moment being sent off to some unknown place, and that's really basically what happened. In the meanwhile, the wife was informed of what had happened, that instead of getting safely across the border, her husband and two girls were taken captive in some other nearby town and whisked away. And again, in war years in Europe, that was basically the end of them. So we can imagine the bitter emotions which overcame her. Her joy at waiting for the word of their deliverance, of making it safely across, transformed into total sorrow. The holiday, Pesach, was a time of total mourning, and she cried endlessly the entire Yantiv. Her world became dark, and it's impossible to describe the sorrowful state in which she fell. However, there was a Rav Shmuel David Unger, who was a big Askan, who was the Avbasin of a city called Nitra, and he, endangering his own life, he raised money, and he was able to bribe the captives and free these three captives. And on the last day of Pesach, they were set free and permitted to return home, and the distraught woman receives a telegram that indeed her husband and her two daughters were saved and they're on their way home. It is needless to describe what sort of effect this, and this is where I picked up again in, you know, on the, in the sheets, of this good tidings put on the soul of this unfortunate woman. And from that moment on, when she gets the word that they were actually freed and they're coming home, from that moment, they're coming home. You thought you were never going to see them again. You thought they were finished. You thought you were bereft, alone, a widow, and a bereaved mother of two girls. And now they're coming home. She waited expectantly for her daughters the whole time. The following day, she couldn't restrain herself and wait for them inside the house. No, she sat by the entrance of the courtyard and with great anticipation awaited the moment of their return. And when they arrived, she burst into tears and overwhelmingly poured out all of the emotions of her heart. On account of the profuse outpouring of emotion, she couldn't even offer words of thanks to Hashem. And he writes, "He who did not witness this reunion, a mother reunited with her daughters after such a dreadful captivity, the tears of the mother when she saw that they were alive and returned home, the joy of the joyous mother of children, if you didn't see that, you never saw true feelings of joy." And then the author writes, "I imagine that such will be the joy of our mother, qualities of the land, the Eretz Yisrael, when we all return home to her bosom after the horrible captivity we now experience. This is how I picture the wondrous joy that the mother will share with her children, with us, and with her. May Hashem grant me the merit that my book will impact the restoration of the children to their borders and to their mother's bosom, and to see the fulfillment of an aim, habanim semecha, of a mother truly joyous at the return of her children." And that's why I entitled this book. Later on in the book, he writes, "That father who took the two girls was me." That was his personal story. One last thought on his introduction. He writes that the land of Israel is our inheritance. It's our Yerusha, which we're reading about in the parasha is now beginning with Lech Lecha. Hashem promises it to Avram, to Yitzchak, to Yaakov, over and over again. And as a natural order, nature will triumph and we will be drawn back as long as we are ready to sacrifice it. It's a natural process. It's going to happen. It will return. The world will return to its natural state. And the natural state is the Jews in the land of Israel. He concludes, I mean, as again, as he wrote a lot in the introduction, I just picked out a few points. But let's conclude with a word to the pioneers. These secular Jews, non-religious, anti-Torah Jews that are indeed building up the land. And he writes a beautiful message to them. "It is as clear as day," he writes, "that the Holy One, blessed be He, desires your deeds and your labor." Again, this is not the message they'd heard from the religious camp. "You have built cities and you have made flourishing gardens from fallow fields. This is the result of great toil and effort, and in many cases involved genuine self-sacrifice. As we know, of course, malaria draining the swamps was not without sacrifice. You transform swamps containing all sorts of disease into flourishing prime soil. And I have cited in this volume many sources which prove that the Holy One, blessed be, is pleased with your actions. And I would like to cite here one additional proof which is impeccable and irrefutable. The Gemara says, Rabbi Yochanan says, why did Omri was a very wicked king described in Tanakh. Why did he deserve kingship? So the Gemara says, how could such a wicked person, such a Rasha, why did he end up with a Malchus? So the Gemara says, because he added on a city to the land of Israel. He built a new city, and as a merit for building a city in Eretz Yisrael, Malchus deserved kingship. Therefore, the Rebbe is writing to these secular Jews, you are building the land. And he writes explicitly, and I didn't quote it here, it doesn't matter whether you have intention or you didn't have intention, you were thinking holy thoughts or not, you're building the land. The fact is, the land is built up because of your handiwork. And therefore it seems to me that the simple Jew, this is an unbelievable sentence he concludes here with, the simple Jew who builds the land without any spiritual intent, he's not thinking Mashiach, he's not thinking redemption, he's not thinking Hashem, he's not thinking anything. He just believes that the Jew should have a homeland of their own. And so he's draining a swamp and planting a vineyard. That Jew who builds land in Eretz Yisrael, even merely for his own benefit, accomplishes a greater tikkun, a greater rectification in the supernal world than the greatest tzaddik with tearful and lamenting midnight prayers. The tikkun chatzos, the holy tikkun chatzos that the chassidim would wake up in the middle of the night. The simple Jew building land and planting a vineyard in the upper worlds is doing more. Tikkun Chatzot is mourning the destruction. The guy planting the vineyard is bringing redemption. That is doing more right now, he writes, than all of the tears of the midnight Tikkun Chatzos for the sake of the Shekhinah and to end the exile. The last point that he writes is that there's a partnership, though. And he implores the pioneers that the development of the land is right now not based on Torah. As amazing as it is, the primary mitzvah, he quotes the Maharsha and the Chassam Sofer, that the main mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is cultivating fields and planting vineyards. They build up the land. That's the main mitzvah. But he writes that there is a partnership. And a nationalism is for other countries, there could be such a thing of just pure nationalism. For Jews, it has to be built around the Torah. And he quotes a Gemara in Sanhedrin that says, if it were not for the learning, the Limud HaTorah of David HaMelech, then his general, Yoav ben Tzrui, would never be successful. If it weren't for David HaMelech sitting in the base of Medrash, Yoav would not win. And if it wouldn't have been for Yoav fighting the battles, then David would never be able to sit in the base of Medrash. And that's the partnership. They're both soldiers. You need those who are out there fighting, and you know those in the base of Medrash learning. And he like extends a hand. Let's partner together. You're building the lands. You're draining the swamps. You're planting the vineyards. You have the expertise. You're making it work. But you have to partner with us and allow the religious community to do what we need to do, to be brought into the land, because Eretz Yisrael is not like any other land. The Jewish people are not like any other people, and we are a spiritual people. We have to have both. So continue building. Do it all. And he implores the religious community to join in, the secular community to join with them and do their work, and that will indeed, the last quote, right? Since the development of the land was not based on Torah, it's imperfect. And that's why we still suffer many losses. He quotes, again, he's writing in 42, the pogroms of 29. All the suffering that we've had is because it's not perfect yet. It's not being built in a Torah way. And we need each other. He says, Shlomo HaMelech, use experts to build the Mikdash. Shlomo HaMelech, he didn't do it. So we're using the experts who know how to develop the land. But partner with us and become one. This is his introduction. This is introduction to Hashem. Next week we'll talk about his approach to the birth pains of Mashiach. Why is there suffering that seems to be so ubiquitous in Jewish life, particularly the time period that he was in? What's the meaning of suffering? And then the third week we'll talk about the idea of then redemption and how that will come about through all of the suffering in the building of the land of Eretz Yisrael. Okay, Mirat Hashem, next Monday night we'll continue. Those who like, we'll daven Maariv now, and see you all next week.
Recording stopped.